Did you folks ever have a good time? Like, did you ever go out to bars or anything?
Oh, yeah, I know. That's something. Oh, believe me. Sometimes I worried about this when I was doing this. I found this a very difficult thing to do because I know it sounded very, very depressing sometimes. And believe me, our life wasn't depressing. It was very happy. Those are the happiest years in my life. I really enjoyed them. And I just was relating that to tell you how we live. Not that we suffered and that we were unhappy and miserable. We had a lot of fun. There were really good sense of humor at the place. And yes, we went out and had... The trouble was that we didn't have any money of our own. And so when Jerry would get some money maybe from his family or I got something or we would maybe go down to the municipal restaurant on Canal Street. And boy, it was eggs and potatoes, never tasted like... I have never tasted eggs like that yet. And occasionally we'd go down to Paul's on Mott Street and get a dish of spaghetti and have a few glasses of beer. We also went down the corner occasionally. Things were pretty cheap then. To Vincent's Clam Bar, and we would have what we call scungili, which had a very special sauce with it. So yes, and also I had a great time, particularly when the summer came around. Visitors came, and people wanted to see New York. And I saw New York the first time in my life through the eyes of visitors who came to the Catholic Worker. I developed a tour, and I would take them around. And when I did that, sometimes I got to see a Broadway show, and somebody would take me to dinner. And I'll never forget one time I took a priest down to the village, you know, which was the sin place, you know. And we got down to the village, and I went to say something to Father, and he wasn't there. And I looked, and he had gone into a hallway, and he took off his collar. Because he was afraid that, you know, going down to the village, that, you know, he would be desecrating the collar. But, no, life was full of fun. We had a lot of people that made us laugh. Stories like Kate Smith. I know we're talking about, she was out picketing one time. And somebody came up to her and said, "Kate, what are you picking?" "Kate, what are you picketing for?" She says, "None of your damn business." And they were dead. And we were getting out the paper one day, and somebody came in and said to her, "I want to change my address." And she said, "Well, you can't do it here. Go on upstairs and do it." And Mr. Breen, he was a character. Mr. Breen was a vitriolic old man sometimes, and he loved and hated Miss Day equally. And lots of times he would yell out the window from the first floor, call her all kinds of things. But also, I remember one of the first things I heard about him was he used to answer our mail, so we always worried. We never knew what he was writing. And sometimes we got some letters back, you know, like one time a person wrote back and said, "I know the Holy Ghost sits on the left-hand side of your shoulder." But no, one time some woman called up and was complaining about Artie's art and that it was sacrilegious. and complained particularly about the one of John the Baptist. And Mr. Breen said, "Listen, lady, if you were in the desert 40 days and 40 nights, you'd look a hell of a lot worse than that." So, no, life at the Catholic Worker was fun, was enjoyable, and I don't think any of us would ever trade those days. Most of my efforts are in convincing people to live a life of voluntary poverty, to do practice the Catholic Worker principles, and in so doing that maybe we can achieve that change of society that Peter always talked about, of building a new society within the shell of the old. I guess you always have trying to live a life of the Catholic Worker is a constant struggle, I think. I don't know that we will ever solve it. Living a life of poverty is different when you're married than when you're single. I found very little difficulty in giving up a lot of things when I was at the Worker. In fact, Miss Day was constantly talking to us about a spirit of detachment from material goods. You know, and there were times I'd say to myself, "God, woman, what else do you want? Blood?" And but no, and I think, you know, when you got a family, there are certain things that you feel responsible for that you have to give them. But you don't have to give them all the fine things and that we are told that are necessities of life. So what you try to do is give your children a sense of values, and I don't think that you can ever transfer your values to your children. I think the only thing that you can do is by your life and by our conversation at table and discussing things, that these things would rub off, and that your children would become aware of them. We definitely would argue back and forth about many things, and in that sense, why I think the children learn things without having to preach to them. In fact, I often remember my daughter became involved in a school thing. One of the teachers was being fired, and he was an exceptionally fine teacher. You very seldom find students defending teachers. You know, most of them, they take or leave. And later on, I found out that my daughter was very much involved in that. And she had gone before the city council to talk in favor of this teacher. So one day she came home, and I had just heard about it. And I said to her, "Paula, I hear you're involved in this thing with Mr. Miller," I believe his name was, "and that you've appeared before the council." And she said, "Yes." And then there was a pause. And later on she came and she said, "And Dad, if you would have told me I shouldn't have done that, I'd have lost all respect for you." So you never know, you know, what your children are hearing and what kind of values that you inculcate. But I don't know that Alice and I will ever be satisfied, or I think any of us will ever be satisfied in solving that problem. I think all we can do is what Peter said, to do with less so others can have more, and struggle along that way. I know I have many things that I hate to give up that Alice reminds me of many times. And that's how you do it. When you got somebody like Alice that reminds you of what you talk about and don't live up to. So I think it's a mutual thing, your wife and the both of us have to recall things. But I don't think that I have achieved what I should. I feel that I've failed many times, and like Dorothy said in the little flower, you know, you just got to pick yourself up and start all over again and keep going. And as they say, keep the faith and hope that some way that your life will influence others, and that you yourself will be more constant in what we say we believe. Well, now, Miss Day used to talk about two different kinds of poverty, you know. The poverty that we had at the Catholic Worker is not the kind of poverty that Dorothy was talking about. That's kind of destitution, you know, in a sense. We're not advocating people living that kind of a life that we lived at the Catholic Worker. But Dorothy and Peter never had anything that I know of. You know, they never had their own room. What they shared, they lived in an open room with other people, like Mrs. Clemens with the axe, you know. So they gave up everything that made life comfortable for most people. So I would say, to a great degree, yes, both Dorothy and Peter, certainly Peter above all people, had achieved that goal of poverty, detachment from the material goods of life. Yes?
Could you comment about what the relations were between yourself and other people in the Catholic Worker with other people in that same time who were struggling for justice in America, like the socialists and communists?
Oh. Well, we were both involved in the same kind of programs, but we definitely made a distinction whenever we would go out on the picket line between ourselves and the communists. They used to try to get us to join a united front, but we would never do that. In many cases, we would start a separate picket line. We put out some leaflets about that there could not be any united front with the communists at that time. We did recognize what they were saying, that they were addressing the critical issues of the day, the things that were unjust, like the rights to organize and the right for interracial justice and things like that. And we refused to leave the field open to them. The problem at those times was that we were leaving the field open to them because they espoused certain things, and immediately Catholics would say, no, we can't do that because that's communistic. And as a result, they were given more credit for things that they weren't responsible for. And we hoped that by our witness and demonstrations that we could counteract that and win the, which at that time we were talking, they talked about that the working man was being lost to the church. And we'd hoped that by our preaching the social gospels and the encyclicals, and Peter always used to say, let's make the encyclicals click. And so that's what we try to do.
Well, didn't Dorothy have close relations with people like Mike Gold?
Oh, yes, yeah. In fact, I remember one time we were going on a trip and she met Earl Browder and she kept very friendly with those people. They were her friends, and why not? You don't forget people like that. And I think she had I don't ever remember her saying anything but nice things about all those people. In fact, we used to love to hear her talk about those days. They were really interesting, very interesting. I remember one time when we even defended the Christian Front, and that really was charity. Sometimes we weren't always as charitable as Miss Day was in some of our... Bill Callahan used to write a column called The Gadfly, which to me always seemed a little out of character to the Catholic Worker. Bill was a pretty aggressive guy, you know, ready for confrontation lots of times. And Miss Day had to hold him back in many instances.
Jerry, were you going to add something there?
We were kind of had a plague on both their houses. And that caused all sorts of conflict.
Oh, yeah.
And within our working relationship.
Yeah, it probably.
Of course, the Catholic Interracial Council, I think, started at the Catholic Church. And most of the relationships with the unions was done through the, was it the Association of Catholic Unions? They used to meet there. There was a working relationship with all of the unions, particularly the Siemens Union and Joe Curran. Curran was a very good friend for years. He never really forgot the times that he helped them. It's a soup kitchen, especially for the seamen when they were on strike. And he never got that. You know, he got to be a pretty big priest. And most of the others, it was the same thing. There was a relationship, but it was kind of held back because, primarily because if you want to stay in business at all, you had to do what the cardinal and the archbishop wanted. You couldn't go too far, in other words. You couldn't really say the things you wanted to say. The things we wanted to say back then came out in this damn good doctrine the bishop just put out on the nuclear war. We just saying those things back in 30 and 33 and getting hit over the head by it. And now they're all in there. You can read some of it in the Catholic Worker. I think they took some of it word for word out there.
I guess Bill Callahan started POX, which was the first Catholic Worker organization for registering conscientious objectors. And Bill was a very active person. He liked to speak and liked to get out at meetings. And at one time, we were really ambitious, particularly during that part. We used to put out press releases. Can you imagine? Catholic Worker. When I think back, I think of what a joke that was. But we'd send out these releases, and I don't know that anybody ever picked them up. But we tried it. Bill had a special form. It was blue and white. And we put out these notices about the conscientious objection of POX and the registering of Catholics. But that ended up being a very big testing ground for people in the Catholic Worker conscientious objection when the war first, the Second World War started. And that became a time when people had to make up their minds, you know. It was good to believe intellectually about something, and we can always do that. But when the time comes, then there becomes a separation, and people were tested as to their conscientious objection with the Catholic Worker, and so many left. I know Dwight LaRue. Dwight was a conscientious objector. Dwight and I went up to started New Hampshire and helped start the civilian conservation camp up there. And then within a very short period of time, Dwight ended up in the infantry. And many of our people went in and fought the good war, you know. To many of us, it was a real problem because to determine what to do and how to do it, many of us were posed with the problem of, should you go to jail? Should you register? Can you work in hospitals? Can you go to civil service camps? It was all a question of conscience. And everybody had to make his own accommodation with his conscience as to what he could do. I know I had a problem. I was married, and I had to get a job. And how do you find a job in a war economy that isn't connected with the war? You know, and to look for a job, those are the kinds of things that you have to do. I ended up working in a Hotel St. George, and then I quit that job for moral reasons because I was a bell captain, and I had to do a lot of things that I couldn't do. But anyway, I ended up working down St. Patrick's Cathedral as tending to the house and the grave down there. The old St. Patrick's Cathedral, yeah. But my accommodation and Jerry, at least we both ended up as ambulance drivers. I don't know how Jerry's mind worked at that, but I worried about it, and I know many of the communists used to complain about us running houses of hospitality and patching up people and sending them back into the system. But we didn't do that, you know. And I think I became an ambulance driver because I felt personally that if these people, and there were many people who were fighting the war in good conscience, you know, we can't just assume that people that were in the war were not there of good conscience. And if they could be willing to die for their beliefs, then I think that was the least that we could do, be willing to die for our beliefs. And this was a form of work of mercy. And in fact, when I was with the American Field Service, I had more respect as a conscientious objector in the Army than I did at home. In fact, at one time, I was invited to speak to the sergeants about the Catholic worker and conscientious objection. And, you know, they respected. But at home, you didn't get that kind of respect. And, of course, in those days, the word conscientious objection was certainly a bad thing. You know, you couldn't talk to anybody about it. Today it's more respectable. People may not agree with you, but at least they'll discuss it with you, and you can talk about it in a more rational manner.
Yes, back here.
Could you comment a little bit on the racial policies of the Catholic worker and how that comes?
On the what? Well, that the civil rights movement was after my time. I mean, I wasn't involved in it because I left in 42, but the interracial problem was always something that the Catholic Worker talked about. In the first issues of the paper, way back in 33, they headlined the Scottsboro cases, you know, if you remember that. As Jerry mentioned, we were all, particularly in the Campions, we had an interracial committee, interracial justice committee, and we belonged to the interracial justice group that was headed by Dr. Hunter at the time. And so we would, the Campions who belonged to that would go and speak on interracial justice to many of the Catholic schools, trying to promote equality and civil privileges for black people. So the Catholic Worker had a really synthesis, a synthetic program. And the thing is that not everybody practiced the whole thing. What happened with people like John Court? They came, they were involved in labor, and as a result, they started the Association of Catholic Trade Unionists. You had people that started the interracial groups, and there were people that were involved in liturgy. So, and some people that were only involved in conscientious objection and peace. But the Catholic Worker itself encompassed all these programs. And I hope that those on the staff at the Worker, we didn't isolate ourselves to any one particular thing, that we espoused all of those and tried to encourage all those programs. But like everything else, people become involved in a personal thing, and they do it, and they make that their cause, which is important.
It's interesting. You say in your talk earlier, you said you got the paper out by 8:30 on the first day. And that's amazing. I'm not getting it out in a month. And I was wondering how to do it.
I
typed out all the addresses. I don't know, Jerry or Joe.
Yeah.
You typed out all the addresses.
Well, we had, on the office side, we had two long tables that were down the wall, and we had typewriters on both of those tables. And we always had, trays of the names and addresses. Those trays were sorted out according to states and cities. I think, if I remember correctly, anything 5 people or more, you put in a bundle, and then the rest of it was miscellaneous. We typed those things up during the month, and we, as I said, read some of those letters. We had people in the house would work on it. Visitors would come down. And, of course, we did. There were days that if we weren't taking care of visitors or anything, we would stay up late into the night to type long trays of, you know, names. It just had to be done. And there was no way that you let it alone. And we would have to cut up all those things and put them in envelopes and sort them out. And then when the day the paper came out, that was really an organized day. We got everybody up early in the morning and lined them up in the office, and we had these envelopes, and people would be folding the papers, and we'd give each person an envelope, which would have a certain state and city. And then on the other side of the building where the bread line was, we bundled up all the bundles. We separated those two. Now, the paper didn't always get out in one day, because lots of times we didn't have enough money to mail the paper out in one day. But towards the end, we were able to do that, as Jerry could well attest to. But we had people like Charlie O'Rourke, pardon me?
With a lot of work.
Yes, it was. It was a major effort. This was something that went on all month long.
You make everything sound so easy.
Yeah.
Damn hard work.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
You get out at 8 o'clock in the morning and talk till noon.
Oh.
You really would. And then afternoon, after you had lunch, you talk again until
dark. Well, Alice, Marjorie Hughes, you know, and Agnes Bird, and, you know, you could go on. Many of the names that you've heard, people come in, and that's all you did all day long was type, type, type. And then we got smart one time. We made carbon copies. But it was very difficult to do that because the carbon did not come off on those gum labels too well. So it wasn't too happy an experience.
Another question?
I just want to make one comment, which was I read someplace the other day that you can count on the fingers of one hand, perhaps, the people that have carried the ideals of their youth into age, if you will, Joe. And I thought to myself, oh, you know, who would I put on my hand? I certainly would put Dorothy, and I would put Peter, but I didn't know either of those people. And so, at the risk of embarrassing you, Joe, you're on my hand.
I love it. Take all the hands I can get.
I think on that wonderful note, we'll stop and talk informally, and we're grateful to God to have such great people among us as Joe Zarella, Jerry Griffin, Alice, Mary Alice Zarella, and of course, to have with us Tamar Day Hennessy and her children.